Sir Joe was at home on his farm at Kingaroy, asked about the possibility of becoming Prime Minister.
Once the government is formed, every hour of the day it'll be a military operation.
He's reluctant to share the detail of his grand plan with his public.
The public know where I'm going, and there's no problem on that.
A newspaper poll which chose him as the best.
The best policy of anybody.
Sir Joe's breakaway National Party.
Dozens and dozens of candidates across Australia.
38 companies and entrepreneurs prepared to back the Premier.
Taxes, lower taxes.
Sir Joe B. Elkin-Peterson.
And when the cronyism corruption allegations seemed set to sink the Nationals,
they can jump in the lake.
Receive more detailed information about corruption.
Sir Joe set his sights on the lodge.
Did you get one of these?
He'd curb union power through Queensland style
crime in the Sunshine State.
The big spending
today
has just begun.
The saviour of this country
heading into a war which only he can win.
When police and politicians can't find an illegal casino
a
in a Brisbane main street.
Political arrogance.
That's detail. That's just detail.
This morning, Police Commissioner Sir Terence Lewis called the allegations a disgrace.
Inquiry into police corruption.
I will not
an independent,
stop
open inquiry.
Investigation
Queensland
into
organised crime.
On the 26th of May, 1987, a commission of inquiry was established, charged with the task of investigating allegations of police corruption in Queensland, Australia's second largest state. The inquiry came at a time of great political upheaval in Queensland. Its long-serving Premier, Sir Joe B. Elkin-Peterson, was fighting hard in a campaign to become Prime Minister of Australia. Allegations of corruption in the Queensland Police Force were nothing new. Five inquiries over 20 years had uncovered nothing. And little in the early stages of the Fitzgerald inquiry indicated that this one would be different.
Did you ever find or have reason to believe that it was quite common for prostitutes to have a drug habit?
I knew of one and I heard of another.
So it was quite an extremely rare thing to find that?
That is correct.
Did you give any direction to your men in relation to liaisons between them and the girls at these places?
As far as meeting them is concerned.
Having relationships?
Yes, there was a definite instruction given to the men.
And what was that?
Well, it was, don't fuck a mole or she'll fuck you.
That wasn't in writing?
No.
But it was expressed, perhaps in different language from time to time?
Usually that way.
What was the procedure for the destruction of seized alcohol?
I pour it down the drain at police headquarters.
This was done under your supervision, or?
My supervision, sir.
So someone at your branch would do that under your supervision?
I would open. There'd be kegs poured down the drain, bottles of whiskey, whatever.
Must have been a heart-rending scene.
Yes.
Some inquiry watchers are becoming a little frustrated that major revelations have not been forthcoming. But breakthroughs may be on the way, as Peter Hall reports.
The cynics around Brisbane have been saying that any corruption in the Queensland Police Force will never be uncovered because of the tradition of solidarity within its closed ranks. But if rumours circulating in the town are true, then we could be in for a flood of sensational revelations. Rumour has it that the Fitzgerald inquiry has been preparing the way to enable it to offer indemnities from prosecution to witnesses in return for their cooperation in naming others who may have been involved in illegal activities.
Yes.
Hello, my friend. It's Terry.
Graham, you still there?
Look, we've had it.
We're all going to go.
It'll be all right if we all stick together.
Yeah.
Colin William Maxwell Dillon.
And you hold the rank of Sergeant First Class?
The licensing branch was responsible for policing liquor, gambling and prostitution. Sergeant Colin Dillon had been a policeman for 22 years, serving two of them in the licensing branch.
I want to ask you about licensing branch officers receiving gifts at Christmas time or at any other time. Did you ever have occasion to experience such a situation firsthand?
Yes, I did.
What occurred?
It was around about Christmas time. I went to work one morning and I had occasion to go to my locker, which was locked, in which I held the only key. It contained my departmental firearm, ammunition. On opening the locker, I found a bottle of scotch. It was a bottle of Chivas Regal. I didn't say anything to anyone. I waited a day, I think it may have been 2 days, when I was next on duty. Harry Burgess came to me and he said, did you get your Christmas prezzy? I said, I beg your pardon. He said, there's a bottle of scotch in your locker and it's good stuff too.
Well, how did you deal with that? What did you decide to do about that?
Well, not wanting to upset him or cause bad blood between he and I took the bottle and I kept it.
Did you ever consume it?
Never. I used to say to that bottle every night, why did I ever bring you home?
Dillon had refused to cross the fine line that separates honesty from corruption. Not so the man who had sought to corrupt Dillon.
Harry Reginald Burgess.
After allegations of corruption had implicated Burgess, he came forward. He was the first witness to appear under indemnity from prosecution.
Granted an indemnity against prosecution for any criminal offence that might be disclosed in your evidence as having been committed by you?
Yes.
In your own case, what can you tell the Commission about free sexual favours in massage parlours?
Yes, I did on occasions.
Well, how would you go about that? How would you arrange for the free situation to take place?
It was usually booked through the receptionist at the parlour.
Yes.
The booking would go through the books. The girl would get paid at the end of the night, paid her normal wage.
Would you pay for it?
No.
And where did this happen in your case?
Fantasia.
Fantasia.
While little may seem to be emerging inside the courtroom at the inquiry, there have been developments behind the scenes. It's believed that negotiations are proceeding with a number of Queensland police who have been offered indemnities from prosecution, conditional on full and honest evidence. Further evidence is expected tomorrow from Senior Sergeant Harry Burgess, one of the first...
After I interviewed Happiter, I discussed the matter of the breach with him. And a few days later, I was in Inspector Dwyer's office.
Mm. And what was said, Mr. Burgess?
Well, he told me it was all right not to proceed with the breaches against Mr. Happiter.
Not to proceed.
And he gave me $1,000 in $50 bills.
To this time, had you had any inkling that there was anything untoward in the licensing branch in the sense of any people being involved in taking money?
No.
So, you were given $1,000 on this occasion by Inspector Dwyer. What happened after that?
Well, on a regular monthly basis, I was given $500 a month.
From whom?
From the inspector.
And that was Inspector Dwyer?
Yes.
And with the retirement of Inspector Dwyer, who was his successor?
Inspector Parker.
What happened after Inspector Parker became Inspector of the Licensing Branch, in relation to whatever occurred between you and him?
There was no difference. Still paid $500.
Who paid?
He did.
And where would he make these payments?
First occasion was in the park when I was taking him home.
Who are we speaking of?
Inspector Parker. Assistant Commissioner Parker.
Is that correct?
There were sensational developments in the Fitzgerald inquiry in Brisbane today when ex-Senior Sergeant Harry Burgess of the Queensland Licensing Branch took the stand. Granted an indemnity from prosecution by the inquiry, he named one of the state's most senior policemen, Assistant Commissioner Graham Parker, as being involved in an entrenched system of corruption.
Don't worry, Dad, we love you. We know you didn't take any money.
How long after he became inspector did the first payment eventuate?
Well, it would have been at the beginning of the next month.
After he was made inspector?
Yes.
And how long did they continue?
Right through until after I'd left there. 2 months after I'd left.
And they were given to you each month?
Yes.
In cash?
Yes.
You've received our notification in the mail. Mr. Parker?
Yes, Mr. Crook.
And you understand the nature of the indemnity that's being offered and the conditions that would be attached to it?
Yes, I understand. I just need some time to consider my position.
You received some payments after you left the licensing branch?
Yes.
From whom did you receive them?
Mr. Parker.
Come on, Lisa, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. Hello. Happy Father's Day, everyone. Where's Dad?
Come
I have something to say to you all. I have two choices. I can take an indemnity or go to jail.
I knew it.
No, very quietly. Yes. Yes. Thank you. I've arranged for you to stay in a safe house.
I'm not hiding down a hole like some criminal.
I'm not having you a sitting duck.
It's a very serious business, Mr. Park.
I know.
My duty is to make sure you're safe.
The commission hid Parker away in a safe location until he was required to give evidence. His health began to deteriorate. Parker's wife, Dawn, had her own ideas about evidence. To protect the family assets, she concocted a scheme to disguise the source of some of Parker's illicit income.
So I rang Tom and told him we were in trouble, and he said, no worries, that's fine, you got the money off me. And then he said to come up to Townsville and he'd organise the paperwork. And I said, well, expect us sooner than you think. I mean, that's a way out. Oh, Bri, all you have to do is account for the house on Bribey, and then we say we've got the $70,000 off Tom, and Bob's your uncle. I mean, everything will be all right, back the way it was. Come on, mate.
They set off on a 1,200-kilometre journey to Townsville in a futile attempt to create false loan documents.
Gonna die.
I'm sorry about all the confusion, but let's not go into that, Mr. Crook. We're in Brisbane now. Oh, yes, he still wants to give evidence. That's why I'm ringing. No, he's under another name.
I propose to adjourn the commission briefly at this point. An important witness cannot attend. But what I'm advised is a genuine reason. I regret if that sounds melodramatic. I propose to go to that witness to enable short, important evidence to be given. I direct that no attempt be made to follow me or to discover the witness's whereabouts.
All right.
Could we have your full name?
Graham Robert Joseph Parker.
Your former rank in the police force?
Assistant Commissioner.
Assistant Commissioner Crime and Services, is that so?
Yes.
Yesterday evening, did you resign from the police force?
Yes, I did.
Is it the case that you have admitted to the commission that you were involved in corruption as a police officer?
Yes.
Is it also the case that you have agreed to cooperate further with the commission with the provision of other information which you may have?
Yes.
And have you been granted an indemnity, subject to certain conditions, in relation to matters that are included in the information which you have provided to the commission?
Yes, I have.
Can we go, please, to your first encounter with corruption?
Can I first say that I held positions of trust in the licensing branch and as Assistant Commissioner for Crime and Services? I betrayed that trust
Yeah, I'd like to apologise to all Queenslanders and to the members of the Queensland Police Force.
By the time Graham Parker took the stand, evidence had emerged of an organised system of corruption run by ex-policeman Jack Herbert. Herbert had fled the country and his whereabouts were unknown.
Well, Jack Herbert said that there'd been a system in progress for quite a long time and that there was some pocket money for me in it. And he gave me $2,000.
In cash?
In cash.
Wrapped in an envelope or just the cash?
I'm not sure on that first occasion if it was cash or in an envelope. Mainly it was in an envelope. He said it related to the areas of not over-policing, gambling establishments, prostitution. And he said that there were about 6 SP bookmakers that wanted protection. And I'm not sure whether or not at this time or later on he said it related to some sex shops.
Did he speak to you at all about whether or not you should involve any other people in it or anything of that nature?
The procedure was that he would give me 3 or 4 or 5 envelopes with initials.
We might just stick to the first occasion at this stage, Mr. Parker. Was this the start of regular contact between you and Herbert, and indeed of regular payments?
Yes.
Well, how regularly did you see Herbert? How regularly were you paid?
I saw Herbert at the beginning of each month.
How was this contact usually made?
It was made by his wife, who'd usually ring the office.
Are you able to tell us what you consider to be a fair average of the amounts you received over this 3-year period on a monthly basis?
I've already told you. I can only estimate it. I've estimated it at about $3,000 a month.
Do you agree that your best estimate of the amounts that you've received as a result of your involvement in corruption over the years was in the order of $130,000?
Yes, that's correct.
You're always paid in cash by Herbert, were you?
Yes.
What did you do with the money?
I kept most of it at home in a tin.
And what was the most you ever accumulated in this tin?
From memory, about $30,000.
I think it's time for a walk, Mr. Commissioner.
Yes. No need to hasten, Mr. Parker. Just take as long as you need.
And you need half a minute.
Did you have any contact with the Commissioner of Police, Sir Terence Lewis, during your service, say, firstly, at senior sergeant level?
No.
Whilst you were inspector?
No, very little.
Whilst you were assistant commissioner?
Yes.
And what were these periods of contact you had with Sir Terence whilst you were assistant commissioner?
We'd meet together as a whole group every morning at 9 a.m. Apart from that, on any urgent matter, if he was available, I'd make contact with him on those occasions.
And that was on a man-to-man basis, was it?
Yes.
Just the two of you in the room?
Yes.
On any of these occasions, was there ever any mention made of the system of payments in which you're involved?
No.
Was there ever any conversation which to you obliquely suggested that there was a common interest between you in this field of corruption?
No.
Did you observe him, Sir Terence, in the early days to associate with any particular group of people?
Well, going back to the 1950s, used to be a whole group together. Mr. Lewis, Mr. Hallahan, Mr. Murphy, on most occasions, Mr. Redmond.
Before this inquiry started, did you really have any in-depth conversation apart from formal police business with the Commissioner?
No, not at all.
Did you ever endeavour to raise the topic of the system of payments in which you're involved?
No, never.
Was your state of mind that you had any opinion one way or another as to whether or not the Commissioner was involved?
I was sure he was.
Is there any reason why you didn't try to raise the topic with him at some convenient opportunity?
Well, I suppose that's something best kept to yourself. That's the only way I can put it.
Why was that?
Well, why tell everybody else about your own corruption?
Can you recall any further conversations with Sir Terence Lewis beyond those you've already told us?
Yes. After Burgess had given his evidence involving myself and Dwyer, I spoke to the commissioner, and he said Big Don suggested that Herbert should leave the country.
Was there another conversation that you can recall when the commissioner spoke to you about a notice that the commissioner had received?
Yes. That was early one morning. He said he'd received a further notice.
This is Sir Terence speaking to you.
Yes.
What did he say?
That he'd received a further notice of allegation.
From this commission?
That his wife was receiving payments, Herbert's wife.
What did you say?
I said, well, that's pretty common knowledge amongst top licensing police. And he said, Herbert must have a pretty big mouth.
In the conversations you had from time to time with Herbert, can you recall where he said half of the money had to go?
Yes. To the top. And higher.
Yes, my friend.
I think you've come to the end of the road, Terry.
Minister, I insist on seeing the Premier. Do you want me to stand down?
Well, that's what the Minister wants, sure.
And what about my position? My superannuation?
I'm sure that'll all be well and good.
The Minister has threatened to stop my legal entitlement. The legal representation?
I said we might have to review the situation if Terry stays on and causes some embarrassment.
Goodness me, yes. We've got to look after the taxpayers first. They'll want us to do that.
Well, I have things to attend to, Joe.
So this is my... this is my reward for loyalty?
I know, Terry. I'm sorry. Well, what can I do? I have to follow the advice given by Cabinet. This time I do.
I've always stuck by you.
Times change, Terry. Things move on. We've got to salvage what we... what give ourselves a chance to keep low. That's the thing for the moment.
A Premier and a Police Commissioner. They'd come together more than a decade before. They'd served each other's interests and ambitions well. Their story is the story of democracy in Queensland.
Nice to see you all here again.
Johannes Bjelke Petersen, Lutheran lay preacher, aviator, and peanut farmer. A man whose youth was spent in poverty, but whose spirit was sustained in the pleasure of clearing the land and opening it up for development.
I believe that in life there are two sides, you might say. There's the spiritual side, there's the material side, and I think day by day, we're all very interested in the material side. We like to be successful. We like to achieve things. And I think this is good, and I like this. And this has sort of perhaps also been my objective and motive to a considerable degree in life. But I also, on the other hand, I believe that there's a spiritual side of life, which is more important because of its eternal values.
When he succeeded to the premiership in 1968, Bjelke Petersen was known for little other than his puritanical views on gambling and drinking. He inherited a gerrymandered electoral system in a state where education had been so neglected that fewer than half of his cabinet members had completed high school. As Premier, he retained the police portfolio. His police commissioner, Frank Bischoff, was notoriously corrupt, collecting handsome payments from a well-organized SP bookmaker protection racket. The middlemen for Bischoff's graft were said to be his favoured police officers, Tony Murphy, Glenn Hallahan, and Terry Lewis. The group was known within the force as the Rat Pack. But it was another issue which would give rise to the first test of his leadership of the party. Allegations of impropriety were in the air.
Do you or any member of your family hold any shares in Comalco?
Well, in regard to this question, let us have first things first also, and I'll answer that question in a few moments. To get the record straight, let me ask you, what's wrong with having shares in either Comalco or Utah? You tell me that. What's wrong with it?
But, Mr. Premier, wouldn't it be a dangerous situation if cabinet ministers held shares in mining companies and then had to make a decision in cabinet about this particular company or the operations of this company?
This, of course, is the emotional side that, of course, you people, and that's your job to sell papers and to create me emotional issues, would raise.
When the press discovered that government ministers had accepted shares on a preferential basis, Bjelke Petersen's ability to handle controversy was put to the test.
Now, gentlemen, in reply, as I said earlier this evening, no, I have no Comalco shares or Utah shares whatsoever. My wife has shares in both these companies by entitlement and by application.
3 days later, the Country Party did little to help his faltering image when they publicly rebuked him.
Accepted principle for all ministers of the Crown to refrain in future from purchasing shares or an interest in any corporation or company which has or is likely to have negotiations with the government involving their operations in Queensland. I submit that to you.
And Bjelke Petersen did little to help himself.
Premier, I'm asking you whether you maintain your attitude that what you did was right and proper, and whether you will continue to hold shares in public companies.
I haven't done anything in this particular issue at all, as you jolly well know.
But you have held shares in companies which have dealings with the public.
You, if you are going to try and misconstrue it just for your own political propaganda, you've got another thing coming.
Mr. Premier, thank you very much.
In October 1970, the growing dissatisfaction with his performance brought on a leadership challenge. Given one night's notice of the move, he set to work, rounding up the numbers, calling in the debts, fighting for his power.
No, don't worry about that.
In the party room the next day, the vote was deadlocked. The casting vote was held by the Premier, and the Premier cast it for himself.
Well, I have a guarantee that all the ministers will support me at any future occasion, and there's no question about that. They gave their complete and utter assurance that I would get their full backing at any time.
Having staved off the challenge, Bjelke Petersen now had to prove his leadership in by-elections in 1971 and a state election in 1972. He needed a vote-winning issue. With the South African Springbok rugby team touring the southern states, heading for Queensland and leaving a trail of protest violence in its wake, law and order was a natural. In July 1971, Bjelke Petersen declared a state of emergency for the duration of the tour, giving police extraordinary powers to stop dissent.
At the outset, I want to assure the people that the decision was not taken lightly, that it was not absurd, and that it was not taken in panic or through overreaction to our responsibilities. It has been quite obvious to those who have read between the lines of media reports in the last few weeks that the most serious attempts yet to cause disruption and create defiance of law and order has been planned for Brisbane.
A massive contingent of 450 police was brought in from the country to reinforce the state of emergency. Housed in army barracks, the arrival of the country squad bore the hallmarks of a military operation. For the TV cameras, police were warned of the dangers they may face.
Find this deceptively innocent party favour.
And at the Springboks Hotel, police three deep and demonstrators in their hundreds faced each other. The new Commissioner of Police, Ray Whitrod, joined his men on the street.
You are obstructing traffic. Now, you must move back off the road, otherwise you have to move yourself. Please go back. Back.
The demonstrators headed for the Royal Exhibition Oval, where the first game was in progress. The Oval was fortressed by the police, the thin blue line between anarchy and order, an impressive display of strength for the media. On the night of the 24th of July, police defied the cries of Commissioner Whitrod to halt and baton charged demonstrators through Wickham Park. As a reward for services rendered, Cabinet granted the state's police an extra week's leave. On the eve of the elections, the police union endorsed the Premier, and so did the public. The elections were a major victory for the government. Law and order had been proved a winner. And it would be 17 years before Bjelke Petersen faced another leadership challenge. But Commissioner Whitrod wasn't so popular. He faced a motion of no confidence from the police union for his soft line on the Springbok demonstrations. A South Australian, Whitrod was considered an outsider, but he was determined to reform the force. He decided to move against the Rat Pack. Tony Murphy was transferred out of the city to Toowoomba and later still to Longreach. Glenn Hallaham was suspended after being charged with extortion. Terry Lewis, for the good of the force, Whitrod said, was sent to the largest and loneliest of police districts, Charleville. When the charismatic Gough Whitlam came to power as Labour Prime Minister in 1972, few could have guessed the part Bjelke Petersen would play in his future. Whitlam gave Bjelke Petersen a new issue, the perils of a socialist government in Canberra.
They are trying to take Australia into an entirely new area, entirely new atmosphere, entirely a new policy. We saw the Prime Minister of Yugoslavia here. We've since learnt their methods of dealing with people. We saw how they arrived with a plane load of men armed with submachine guns. We had our first taste here in Australia of what it's like to live under a communist regime.
Give democracy a fair go.
His masterstroke against Whitlam came in 1975 with the death of Queensland Labor Senator Bert Milliner. Bjelke Petersen broke with convention by refusing to accept the replacement nominated by the Labor Party. His view of an acceptable Labor candidate found form in his own nominee, Albert Patrick Field.
What are the things you feel strongly about, Senator?
Oh, homosexuality, incest, abortion, and pornographic literature.
What causes you to have strong feelings about these things?
Because I dislike it, really dislike it. I don't think it should be ever brought up in the House of Parliament.
Field's appointment swung the balance of power in the Senate. The man chosen by Bjelke Petersen to represent Labour crossed the floor to vote with the opposition against the granting of supply. Deprived of the necessary finance to run the country, the government was dismissed by the Governor-General.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
God save the Queen!
Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
Bjelke Petersen had demonstrated that he could wield power in the national arena. Having met with Bjelke Petersen at Charleville, Inspector Terry Lewis kept in touch. He wrote of his own academic achievements, his police decorations, his practical fieldwork. He proposed a restructuring of the force, offering a vision of a police force in harmony. I'm acceptable to the Queensland Police Union executive and over 95% of members of the police force, he wrote. He also wrote of Whitrod. The Labour Party holds Whitrod in high esteem, he said. Gough Whitlam had visited Whitrod at police headquarters. Whitrod was again antagonising the police union. In the space of 2 months, he had called for 2 inquiries into police action. The first was in response to the bashing of a student in a demonstration on Brisbane's Coronation Drive.
Are we talking about one particular incident where an officer was alleged to have hit a girl with a baton? Is that mainly what you're looking at?
Well, largely, but Mr. Spencer asked me to inquire into the whole affair from the start of the march at the campus until the end at the city square.
Across the nation on the evening news, the Coronation Drive bashing provoked a public outcry.
The police are entitled to maintain the law of the land. And in the situation in which they developed, that developed down there today, the police had a responsibility, and they carried out that work in a very responsible way.
Would you condone the use of police batons to hit
picketers? I condone completely and utterly the actions that any policeman takes in any situation in which he finds himself, in a, particularly in relation to them.
The Minister for Police, Max Hodges, supported Whitrod's stand. Bjelke Petersen removed Hodges from the police portfolio, and the Coronation Drive inquiry was abandoned.
Why? Did you regret that decision?
Well, again, Andrew, I don't feel I can have any personal feelings.
There's no uncertainty over your future at the moment?
None at all.
Police commended the Premier for his distinct stand against groups acting outside the law. Whitrod's second inquiry was prompted by a drug raid on a small hippie community at Cedar Bay in the far north of Queensland. A seaborne force with a naval patrol boat and a customs launch was mobilised. The massive operation resulted in 12 arrests, 4 for possession of marijuana and 8 for vagrancy. The residents accused police of destroying their possessions and burning their homes.
First of all, it was government property. They hadn't got permission to live there.
Well, there's some doubt about that as to whether it was a miner's homestead lease or not.
Well, that's another question. We don't need to go into those sides of the such.
Bjelke Petersen wouldn't sit back while his police were criticised.
Well, we are aware of certain things that were attributed to the police that were not legally or morally or couldn't be attributed to the police at all because they deny it.
When commune members brought a formal complaint against the police involved, Whitrod ordered the inquiry. 4 police were eventually charged. None were convicted. Inspector Lewis must have sensed that his time had come. He dispatched a 3-page list of people he believed would give character references should the Premier request them. They included Cabinet Ministers, Members of Parliament, Supreme Court Judges, District Court Judges, an ombudsman, and high school principals. On the 14th of November, Commissioner Whitrod called in to hear which of his nominees for a vacant assistant commissioner's position had been selected by Cabinet. He learnt that all of his suggestions had been ignored. Cabinet had made a surprise appointment, a certain inspector from Charleville.
The government's view seems to be that the police are just another public service department, accountable to the Premier and Cabinet through the police minister, and therefore rightly subject to directions not only on matters of general policy, but also in specific cases. This is an interpretation which could have a deal of political appeal, but it is one quite contrary to my own belief. For me, there is urgency to ensure a more effective buffer between police and politicians. If the Premier or the government don't want certain laws enforced generally, they should seek to persuade Parliament to amend them. If the Premier wishes to change the authority and responsibility of the Commissioner of Police, he should seek to amend the Police Act. Interference with the Commissioner's responsibility had reached the stage where I was no longer in command of the force. I was not prepared to be merely a front for other people's decisions in areas of my responsibility. The only way I could draw attention to this situation was by resigning.
Well, of course, he obviously tried to pursue a set course the way he thought. Fair enough, that was his job. But you've got
was
to...
Was that a different course to the one that you had set?
No, the simple fact is that a government has a policy. A government has certain attitudes in relation to certain issues. It's our responsibility. We're the ones who go to the ballot box. No man in any areas, that is what I was saying, can sort of say, I'll do it this way, irrespective of whether it goes down with the policemen themselves or with the government and so on.
Is it true that the Premier has been doing the rounds of police stations in Queensland for the last year, seeking a replacement for yourself?
I've not heard that before.
Is the Premier, in fact, the
de facto police minister?
I don't want to answer that question.
Of course, we know the basis under which the rank and file of the union generally repeatedly demanded his resignation. It was a difficult situation. It wasn't a political one.
Did you have any part to play in his resignation?
No, I wouldn't say that I did, other than I wanted to make sure that we had the confidence of the police force.
Can I ask you something which is suggested by Mr. Gilbranson, a former colleague of yours? He said your resignation is a victory for the forces of corruption you had been fighting since you came to Queensland. Would that be a fair comment?
It's an inference which could be drawn, I think, reasonably.
Is there widespread corruption in the force, sir?
Not widespread corruption.
Will it increase following your resignation?
I can't predict the future.
Mr. Wishart, Lewis is quite more of
the corruption tape.
Toleration for a financial benefit of certain illegal practices.
SP booking one?
Yes.
What others?
Prostitution. Gaming.
Sir, was the appointment of Mr. Lewis as the new commissioner, or as assistant commissioner, the straw that broke the camel's back? In other words, forced you out of the force?
Yes, it was. I don't think he's the most suitable person for that vacancy.
Why not, sir?
Why?
No, I cannot.
Are there any doubts in your mind about his background, about the way he's gone through the police force?
I don't want to answer that question.
Do you think he's a capable man, sir?
Of impropriety.
Say again?
I have heard some suggestions of impropriety by Commissioner Lewis.
I don't want to answer that question.
Do you know why Mr. Whitrod resigned?
Personal reasons, he informed me.
Do you accept that as being a true statement of fact?
I accept that, yes.
You don't consider that he might have thought his position was untenable, that he couldn't continue?
I wouldn't say so. That's what he told me.
Would it have anything to do with the list of police transfers and promotions that went through a week or two ago?
I wouldn't know. He told me it was personal reasons.
Now, a new commissioner of police was needed. Normally, the deputy commissioner would fill the post until an official appointment was made. But these were unusual times. Jumping more than 125 positions in less than a fortnight, Terry Lewis was appointed Commissioner of Police.
It's been suggested that you've, at some stage in your career, been on the take, that you've been a bagman.
Well, it's certainly all foreign to me, the validity of this.
What was your relationship with the Rat Pack?
Well, it's a funny term, that one, because I suppose if we look back far enough, that was one, I think, that was used in relation to Frank Sinatra, if we look back that far.
But specifically, in Queensland,
I've only heard of it from two different areas, if I can put it that way. It was, I understood it to be something that was coined up in the mind of one of our mentally disturbed sergeants that we had in the police force. And the other one, that it was used by a small, very, very small group of people in the police department to cast these malicious rumours around.
I'd like to talk about the image of the force overall now, and the coshing of a student, well documented on television film, that your predecessor deemed that an inquiry was warranted to find out what did happen and why. He was overruled by the Premier. Is it right for the Premier to overrule you?
Well, I don't think he will.
But he has done it in the past.
Well, what he's done in the past, Mr. Ollie, is a matter between him and my predecessor. I am quite certain...
The point is, there is a precedent. Would you like it? Do you think it's justified?
Well, I don't think it will happen again.
Why don't you?
Well, I don't think that this will be the way that I'll be expected to run my job.
I don't follow that answer. Why don't you think it will happen again? If it's happened once, what's changed?
Well, I don't know of any change at all. I can only answer you as probably simply as I can and say that I do not expect any political interference whatsoever in my running of the job. What the reasons were for previous political interference, if any, I don't know.
When Terry Lewis took the reins as commissioner, he recalled his old friend Tony Murphy from exile in Longreach to head the Crime Intelligence Unit in Brisbane. By 1978, Lewis was seeing another old friend. Jack Herbert was a former policeman and Rat Pack associate. Acquitted of corruption charges in 1976, Herbert was now establishing himself as a middleman between criminals and corrupt police.
Oh, sorry, I'm mad.
All right, I needed the sleep.
2,000.
Peel yourself 500.
The results of some poor sod who gets happy gambling on a pinball machine.
According to Herbert, he suggested to Lewis on another occasion that somebody be placed in the licensing branch, preferably an inspector or a senior sergeant, so that illegal betting could be drawn into their corrupt network. The licensing branch was responsible for prostitution, liquor and gambling. It was under the command of Inspector Alec Jefferson, a Whitrod man. In a series of coincidences, Jefferson's pet dog was shot, one of his men was transferred out of Brisbane, and the car of another was firebombed. In January 1979, Lewis proposed to Cabinet that Jefferson go. A month later, he was transferred. 3 months after that, Senior Sergeant Harry Burgess was appointed to the licensing branch. He was joined by Inspector Noel Dwyer in 1980, and in the same year by Inspector Graham Parker. All three men received corrupt payments from bagman Jack Herbert. Herbert alleged paying Lewis a total of $611,650. Burgess, $211,000. Dwyer, $80,000. And Parker, $331,000. In his evidence, Parker admitted to receiving less than half of this amount. In 1977, with his fourth state election due, Bjelke Petersen introduced legislation which effectively banned street marches. He told demonstrators not to bother applying for march permits because they wouldn't get them.
But all we say is, in supporting the police, that we are not going to agree or encourage these people to think that they can go around and inflict their views of disharmony, of defiance, of law and order on the rest of the community through the streets of the city.
Not surprisingly, banning street marches produced street marches. Disturbed by the new legislation, the church has appealed to the government to change its policy.
We believe that we sin by omission, and that we sin corporately as a Christian community when we passively consent to legislation, to political and economic and cultural structures and practices which are unjust or oppressive or deny human rights.
Bjelke Petersen declared that the churches were being manipulated by communists. In October 1977, a National Uranium Mobilization Day took place. Thousands of people throughout Australia took to the streets to protest the continuing mining and export of uranium.
This is an unlawful protection, as no permit has been issued. I now prohibit the holding of this protection.
Bjelke Petersen called in his own army, the police. Elsewhere in Australia, the marches were a community event. In Brisbane, it was war. Thank you.
purpose of the march, of course, is to involve a lot of people, hurt a lot of people, hurt the community. And when you see what goes on...
I'm sorry, why do you say it is to hurt a lot of people? Certainly to involve the community, but why do you say it's to hurt a lot of people?
Well, if you get mixed up in one of these marches and protest meeting and you get hurt, don't come and ask me why you got hurt, but you can't seem to help it, can you? Yeah. That's about what the answer is.
People were arrested, and the Okie Peterson congratulated the police for their excellent work. Three weeks later, the Okie Peterson recorded another big election win. Though his coalition partner, the Liberals, suffered election losses in the city, the Nationals increased their vote in the country.
More good government.
The Okie Peterson's true constituency had endorsed the Premier as their defender of law and order.
As part of the National Party thrust to make Queensland the money capital of Australia, my government will initiate legislation to develop the money market.
A snap election in October 1983 decimated the Liberal Party as the Okie Peterson's coalition partner. Two Liberal members, Don Lane and Brian Austin, joined the National Party, deserting their Liberal colleagues.
Leaves the Liberal Party two members less. I think it's down to five at the moment, getting closer and closer to be able to hold those meetings in the telephone box.
Their defection delivered the Premier a long-held dream, to rule in his own right. Seemingly invincible, the time had come to enjoy the fruits of power. In June 1984, the Okie Peterson was awarded a knighthood for his services to the people of Queensland. In 1986, Sir Joe repaid his Commissioner of Police for a decade of loyalty with a similar honour. Sir Terence became the first policeman in Australia to be knighted. As knights, they joined the Okie Peterson's close friend, confidant and financial adviser, Sir Edward Horton Lyons. Sir Edward was known as Top Level Ted for his habit of saying, "I'll see to it at the top level." But while those with power enjoyed centre stage, a series of scandals were waiting in the wings. As early as 1982, Senior Constable Bob Campbell blew the whistle on police corruption.
And the only reason we don't come up to Mr. Biggs is that Mr. Biggs... entrepreneurs, businessmen in this state, working completely in conjunction with senior police officers.
But how can those senior policemen act as masterminds criminally? How can that flourish?
It can flourish because they have the full protection of the National Party in this state.
The police commissioner acted. He took out a writ claiming that he had been defamed. Cabinet agreed the public should pay his legal fees. In 1984, it was revealed that police at high levels had ignored evidence of a child pornography ring involving Police Constable David Moore. Moore and his puppet, Agro, were the public face of the police department's Stranger Danger television campaign.
I think a lot of people say bad things about police, and the young people listen to them. We want to portray to the youth that the police are your friends, that they're the people that you can turn to in times of trouble or problems.
As the scandal grew, the police minister avoided mention of Moore's name.
At that stage, there was no involvement. Part. Look, can you please drop that word for me?
For 2 years, Commissioner Lewis had defended Moore and covered up the allegations. Moore was eventually convicted of indecently dealing with a 16-year-old. Then came allegations of connections between donations to the party and benefits received.
I was asked to give $10,000.
Why?
Well, I was told that I was a wealthy man and that I could afford it and that I should head the list for Central Queensland. Now,
Who asked you to give the money?
Well, somebody from the hierarchy of the National Party approached me, and as he did others. And I feel that if that was a situation that I was to be seen to donate, and had I been appointed to cabinet as a result, it could well have been said that I bought my way into cabinet.
Which came first, the cheque and the knighthood, or...?
The cheque and the knighthood.
Or the 100,000?
Oh, no, I paid the 100,000 before I received the knighthood.
In 1985, it was revealed that Sir Edward Lyons, chairman of the TAB, had bet more than $300,000 on TAB credit in breach of TAB rules.
Do you have full confidence in Sir Edward?
Absolutely. No question.
In August 1986, 2 months before the state election, Queensland learnt that media magnate Alan Bond had paid the Premier $400,000 in an out-of-court defamation settlement. Bond later said that this was the price of doing business in Queensland. With the Nationals' popularity falling to just 30% of the vote, the electorate was clearly worried when the next blow came, this time from within the establishment itself. Sir Roderick Proctor was a trustee of the National Party.
There are a number of inconsistencies in Queensland as far as treatment of various people and various companies.
They call it cronyism, of course.
That's right.
The Nationals panicked, and only a four-day $3 million advertising blitz delivered victory.
I've got some wonderful news for Queensland. We're going to remain strong and secure. We're going to have stable government.
Backed by a coalition of entrepreneurs dubbed the White Shoe Brigade, Bjelke Petersen commenced a campaign to become Prime Minister of Australia.
We've got a team of men who have organised the policy, attitudes, positions that we take. Once the government is formed, every hour of the day, it'll be a military operation. We know where we're going, we know what we're going to do.
As he trod the campaign trail, the Courier Mail published a series of articles by journalist Phil Dickey detailing the existence of an organised and lucrative vice industry in Brisbane. In May 1987, a television report gave the allegations national prominence. Moonlight State, by Chris Masters and the Four Corners team, raised the spectre of a sophisticated police protection racket with links to organised crime.
Break his camera and break his mouth too, was the order.
The conservative voters of the National Party's electoral heartland now saw the underside of Bjelke Petersen's moral self-righteousness.
Indeed, it must be a puzzle for the many good Christians of Queensland, including the Premier himself, that such ungodliness can occur in such a godly place.
I have complete and utter confidence in our police commissioner and police force. Complete. Absolutely. I've always supported them. I have had a lot to do with them. I see and I know how they operate.
Without consulting the Premier, Police Minister Bill Gunn announced an inquiry into police corruption.
There's been a series of police ministers that have had this hanging over their head. And it's not going to hang over my head, I can tell you. I'm going to go out and I'm going to get it done.
According to Jack Herbert, he and Lewis now thought it necessary for their wives to look after the exchange of money. The Fitzgerald inquiry into possible illegal activities and associated police misconduct began its public hearings on the 27th of July, 1987. In the wake of Graham Parker's admission of corruption, Commissioner of Police Sir Terence Lewis is stood down on the 21st of September. His diaries, kept meticulously for the duration of his time as Commissioner, reveal a network of names, from Bjelke Petersen and top-level Ted down to bagman Jack Herbert. Having lost the support of the electorate and the party, Bjelke Petersen is forced to stand down as Premier in December 1987.
I'm going to be free. Isn't that great? Say cheerio to all you nice people. All the best. See you later.
Herbert is arrested with his wife Peggy in London in February 1988. In return for an indemnity and protection, they agree to give evidence. Over 12 days in September 1988, Herbert lays bare the system of police protection and graft known to participants as the joke. He tells of regular payments to the commissioner himself at the corner of Albert and Elizabeth Streets, in the bar of the Park Royal Hotel, and at the crest. The meeting places are corroborated in codes found in Lewis's diaries. For over 14 months, the inquiry cross-examined police, ex-police, casino operators, corruption fighters, brothel keepers and prostitutes. Beyond them, the trail leads to politicians.
I'm mentioned in the same way as Judge Broad. I'm mentioned in the same way as Pratt. I'm mentioned in the same way as one or two other ministers. I'm mentioned. Now, they are all at work. They're all still in their office. And I've been sacked.
Shortly after, Don Lane put his face in his hands and sobbed violently.
It's been a very hard and trying 12 months. I'm pleased that portion of it is over.
And in its last few weeks, the inquiry attempts to raise the curtain on the world of three men, three knights of the realm, who perhaps more than any had put their stamp on the Queensland system of the 80s. It was to become quite a battle of wills.
There were throughout Commissioner Lewis's time in that office recurring allegations of corruption at a high level in the Queensland Police Force. Is that a fair statement?
Not as far as I am concerned. I don't recall anyone giving any evidence or proof that there was corruption at high level, no.
Is not the position this, though, that at various times throughout the years of Mr. Lewis's service as commissioner, there were episodes that attracted a great deal of publicity in the media, in which people alleged that corruption had reached a high level in the Queensland Police?
I don't recall it.
Former Assistant Commissioner Parker has confessed to being corrupt.
That is true.
Other senior officers have confessed to corruption.
Yes.
And there is a lot of evidence that corruption extended to a very high level indeed.
Yes.
And there is indeed even evidence that the police may have been involved in organising areas of corruption.
That is true.
Well, knowing what has been revealed now about the extent of corruption in the police,
yes,
with the benefit of hindsight, are there any things that you can recall seeing or hearing that indicate that there were signs of corruption in the Queensland Police?
No. There's nothing I can recall that indicated to me that there was corruption.
Is this your position? Maybe that there was mention over the years of the Deputy Commissioner looking at some suspected corruption within the force, but you can't recall the details. Or is this your position? That you have no recollection at all of there ever being a suggestion of corruption being suspected in the police?
No, I think I would have to have the first one, that there could have been something the deputy had looked at that I wasn't aware of.
I don't find that any clearer, I'm sorry. In your statement, you say, I had no knowledge of or suspicion of corruption in the Queensland Police Force.
That is correct.
Well, is that correct?
That is correct.
Would you agree with the view that the manner in which you met with Commissioner Lewis and thereafter the Premier may be construed by some as being evidence of a kitchen cabinet?
No, I wouldn't.
How would you describe a kitchen cabinet?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't know. I've never been in a kitchen cabinet.
Not even with your wife?
Well, that's different. That's not a kitchen cabinet.
Perhaps if I put this to you, that a kitchen cabinet in political science terms relates to people advising senior levels of the ruling party who are not necessarily elected members of the party and whose opinions are relied upon by the leader or leaders of a particular party for the purposes of coming to decisions and carrying out the work of government. That is a broad definition. I'm sure there are others. But in that background, if you and Commissioner Lewis and Sir Joe had met at the executive building and discussed matters that you had discussed over the years, each with the other, would you agree that it falls within that particular definition?
I don't think I need to give you my opinion on that, because it's something that's never happened. I was never, as I can't recall, ever being in the Premier's office with Sir Terence Lewis.
Now, would you go to page 22 of your statement? You group people according to the degree of closeness of their relationship with you. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Your words and the words that you chose were special friends. There were the former Premier, Sir Edward Lyons, Mr. Justice Vasta, Judge Pratt, and Mr. Lane.
They were special friends.
Yes.
What was your reaction when the police commissioner was sitting in your office and starting to discuss matters that perhaps should be confidential to police? I mean, matters that are political and perhaps outside the sort of things you would expect a commissioner of police to be discussing too openly.
I was amazed. I was surprised. I wondered why he wanted to discuss it with me. And then I thought, well, maybe he thinks I do know something. But then I thought, maybe he just wants somebody to talk to. You see, when you get in these positions, you get very lonely. You don't know who you can trust. You don't know who you can't trust. It sounds a bit strange, but I will come back to it again. When you're alone, I don't know if you've had the experience of being alone in a big world, but believe me, when you are, you sometimes do some very strange things. You won't harm anybody. You won't, not deliberately, break confidences, but you do clutch at straws, especially with somebody you respect and think highly of. Do it as you get older, and then you don't do it. You've got to rely on yourself. This is only human nature.
This man was 55 at this stage. He wasn't in his 70s.
No, I know that.
Sir Terence was asked to describe his relationship with 14 different people, including yourself.
Yes.
And the way he described it was thus. He said, I regarded Sir Joe Bielke Peterson, Sir Edward Lyons, the Honourable Mr. Justice Vaster, His Honour Judge Pratt, and the Honourable D.F. Lane as special friends, with whom I could discuss any matter in confidence. Would you say that is an accurate description of the nature of the relationship you had with the Commissioner?
Well, I would say a lot of people. I should say hundreds and hundreds of people in the public service in different departments would say exactly the same thing, that they could trust me, that they looked to me for support or direction, no question about that. As far as being close, he was no closer than anyone else. I would expect him to say that, because I was always courteous, I was always prepared to listen.
He says he could discuss any matter in confidence with you, given the nature of his relationship with you.
Oh, well, that would only be really mainly in relation to police matters generally. There could have been a few odd other times, but he wasn't one of those with whom I was involved, really, in the political side or any other side. There are different degrees of friendship. There's those you visit in your home regularly and so on. Go out together, go on holidays together, but he certainly wasn't in that category. I never visited his home.
Well, he used to have little bits of paper that he would pull out of his pocket and refer to. Then he would say, what do you think of this? What do you think of so-and-so? Possibly it was about this time that he wrote his first long list. That did concern me a bit.
The meetings were becoming almost official, weren't they? And he is producing an agenda of them.
Well, that's why I said they were spasmodic. As I said earlier, I think he was a very lonely man. He didn't know who he could trust. And I think he thought, this is the only way I can assess it, that the Premier trusts him, so therefore he must be trustworthy. I think this is the way his thinking was formulated.
Sir Terence, we've got to the stage where we know you took an agenda into the meeting with the Premier on the 5th of May, which had as its first item New Zealand trip.
Yes.
The second item, poker machine inquiry?
Yes.
The third item, something concerning commissioned officers' course at the college?
Yes.
The next item, optional retirement?
Yes.
The next item, Sir Edward Lyons' confidant?
Yes.
The next item, Sergeant Trump?
Yes.
The next item, use of government aircraft?
Yes.
The next item, Judge Angela Vasta?
Yes.
The next item, media bias?
Yes.
The next item, favourable letters?
Yes.
The next item, inquiries into police in Western Australia and South Australia?
Yes.
And the final item, federal push, crime commission?
That's correct.
Good. Well, I put it to you again that it is nonsense to suggest that you put on an agenda of items covering that range of matters Judge Angelo Vasta, merely to remind the Premier that you had had lunch with him the day before?
No. That's not nonsense at all.
Good evening, sir. You're observed driving in an erratic manner. I wonder if you'd blow in the bag for me, please.
No, I'm not fooled, Terry. I'm not fooled. Of course, I wouldn't blow in the bag. They brought me back here. Could you do something about it? Well, I don't want to spend the bloody night in the boob. They say I am, but I'm not, Terry. I'm not fooled.
All right. Put me on to Squassani.
Oh, good.
Commissioner?
Who's this?
Inspector Squassani, sir.
He's drunk.
Yes. 0.12. Way over.
And how far's it gone?
What do you mean by that, sir?
You know he's the Premier's right-hand man. In fact, he and the Premier and I have just spent the evening together.
I see.
I think we can stop going any further with this one, Inspector. Do you understand?
We've started the charge sheet, sir.
I don't care about that. Now let me talk to Bracken.
Yes, Commissioner?
How is he?
He's full as a fowl.
Other than my mother, he is the only bloke I'd like to do something.
Yeah, but he's pissed.
I want you to drive him home.
Terry?
Forget it.
Leave it to me. Leave it to me.
Mr. Bracken went on to say, and it is in the same telephone conversation with you, after he had said that Sir Edward was as full as a fowl, you said, other than my mother, he's about the only one in the world I would like to do something for. Did you say that?
That would be very strange. I say I didn't say it.
You deny saying that?
Yes. By the simple fact that my mother doesn't own a car. She lost one eye. And so she doesn't drive. So why would I use her as a case to say, you know, I want to do something for him because she's the only one I would do something for. I think that's not a very good analogy at all.
Well, that's not much of an answer, is it? Isn't what Bracken is saying is that there are two people who are so close to you that you would do basically anything for? Your mother and Sir Edward Lyons? Isn't that what he is saying?
Yes. That is what he's saying, certainly.
I would like to be recognised.
And there hasn't been a police commissioner in all the history of Australia that's ever received a knighthood. And it'd be a wonderful thing for Hazel.
I suppose I could mention it to him again.
Oh, Ted, I don't think I've got that many good years left.
I'll have a word with him.
Thank you.
The governor may get in the way again.
Oh, I don't know. Joe'll fix it this time.
Any idea on this honours list?
No.
Terry's spoken to me about a knighthood. In fact, three or four people have approached me.
What about a knighthood for Terry?
No, for themselves. I don't know whether it's wise. We'll set a precedent for the police. What do you reckon?
Well, he's mentioned it to me. I think if you want to do it, it can only benefit you politically. It won't be seen as a decoration for Lewis. You'll be honouring the police force. That's the way they look at it, I know. No, I can't see it doing anything but good.
Talking about, haven't you got it settled?
He wants 400,000.
Well, pay it.
What do you mean?
Well, I know what he's like and how determined he is. If I were you, I'd pay it and save yourself a lot of trouble. Settlement. I tell him to pay it, the 400,000.
Thank you.
I've had it in here for a little while. There you are. 100,000. Sparks has got the other half of the party.
My goodness, you can't hold all that in your safe. We'll have to get rid of it, and quickly.
Note one of the front page A.
It's the list of donations.
Yes, here we are.
The very first one, the deposit slip date was 29th of September, 1986.
Yes.
You will see the first one there hasn't been blacked out.
No.
Because it's cash?
Yes.
And the amount is $100,000?
Yes.
Can you tell us the source by which it came through to you, to your solicitors, to go into the bank?
Yes, all right, through the Premier.
Now, you did tell us yesterday that you had a memory that one of the things that precipitated the Cal deal set-up was the Premier receiving a cheque for $100,000.
Yes.
Could it in fact have been this amount of cash of $100,000 that the Premier received?
Oh, I don't think it was. In fact, I'm quite sure it wasn't.
It does seem, does it, that the first amount received by Cal deal?
Well, as it's placed there, it would appear to be that way.
It does seem, does it, that this is the first donation of $100,000 which led to the setting up of Cal deal. An amount of cash in the sum of $100,000 received by the Premier.
Well, it certainly does, Mr. Commissioner. It certainly was the first donation.
Is it correct that you now accept that it was a cash receipt by the Premier and not a cheque which was received?
Well, as far as I'm led to believe, it was cash. Yes, there's no doubt about that.
Sir Edward gave some evidence, and you yourself, in your statutory declaration, make mention of it also, how Cal deal came to be set up, and the purpose for which it was set up.
True.
You say it was set up in 1986 to give financial assistance to National Party candidates nominated by you.
Sure.
Well, the evidence so far indicates that the circumstances in which Cal deal was established were, according to Sir Edward Lyons, that you had told him you had received a substantial donation.
Sure.
At one stage he said he thought it was a cheque of $100,000, and then later on he agreed it was cash of $100,000.
Sure.
Is it the position that generally you didn't know the identity of the donors to Cal deal?
Very, very, very often, yes.
Very often you didn't?
No.
Well, sometimes you did.
Sometimes we did, if I happened to be there when they called.
Can I take you to the evidence Sir Edward Lyons gave in relation to the donations to Cal deal?
Sure.
On page 20521, when asked if he told you of the identity of the donors, he said, "I always did tell him." That's you. Because I didn't think it was politic to put him in a situation where he mightn't know somebody gave a substantial sum. That's what Sir Edward Lyon said was the general position.
What I would say to you, sir, is that there were lots and lots and lots of money came into the party over the years, and I never attempted to remember any of it.
Did you know he was bringing money when the arrangement was made for him to come and see you?
No, I didn't know he was bringing money. No, I didn't.
So he was sitting in your office as a person introduced to you as a prospective investor in Queensland?
Yes.
And he suddenly produced a large wad of cash?
Well, the person concerned had organised that. I hadn't.
No, Sir Joe, I'm just trying to recreate the scene. Is that what occurred? You'd had a discussion about investments in Queensland, and I assume you were very enthusiastic about that?
Yes.
Is that what happened? He then produced a large amount of money?
No, I said to you, sir, a moment ago, that I didn't speak to him that night for more than 10 minutes. I think he came to the door, as I recall. My secretary was always there, and they announced why they had come, and they handed a bag over to my secretary. And that was the exercise as far as I am concerned.
Did he say anything to you as the bag containing the cash was handed over?
Well, he said, like everybody else who came with checks or whatever, he said, "We want to help the party. We are interested in the way you operate." And that's all there is to it.
Can I ask you about your position on the Raffles board?
Yes.
Now, you were on the Raffles board at the same time as you were chairman at TAB.
Yes.
Did you feel any conflict between the two?
No, none at all.
In any particular matters that arose?
No, none at all, none at all.
Now, there was approval given for the TAB to invest some of its money in a number of institutions, and one of those institutions was Raffles.
Yes.
Did you speak personally with the Premier about whether Rothwell's could be placed on a list of approved institutions or investments on behalf of the TAB?
Yes, I did.
Did you suggest Rothwell's to him?
Well, I mentioned it.
Did Rothwell's make any donations to the National Party?
Yes, I believe they did.
There was a donation made by Rothwell's to the National Party in October 1983.
Oh, I think there was one for 25,000, or was 50,000, was it?
25,000.
Yes, there was one.
Did you tell the then Premier of this donation by Rothwell's?
Well, I can't answer yes, I did, or no, I didn't. I think I might have told him because of his knowledge of me and knowing I was on both boards. Yes, I think I might have told him that. Because I can't swear I did, but it is more likely I did than I didn't.
Parker resigned on the 16th, Sir Terence.
I don't remember the dates, Mr. Chairman.
And it was announced on the 17th that I had gone and taken evidence from him at an undisclosed location at which he admitted his corruption.
Sure. As I said, I don't remember the dates. I can remember the events happening.
You don't doubt any of that?
Oh, no.
Sir Terence, it is true, isn't it, that the reason why you decided at this time in September to transfer your half-interest to your wife was that you were feeling poorly. That is true, isn't it?
Sure. I had been for some time.
You were feeling poorly because Parker had rolled over. Isn't that so?
Definitely not.
What other explanation?
Well, it certainly didn't make me happy, but it did not precipitate these events, Parker rolling over.
Bad neck, hey?
Something like that.
Sir Terence, in March 1986, there was another dinner where you and Mr. Justice Vasta were present. Is that correct?
Yes.
Your diary records you attending a dinner at Roseville Restaurant, along with the Premier, Mr. and Mrs. Gunn, Sir Edward and Lady Lyons, Mr. Justice Vasta and his wife, and Judge Pratt and his wife.
That's correct.
Well, would you look at this note, dated the 5th of March, 1986. It appears to be another thank you note received by you from Mr. Justice Vasta.
Were you the host at that dinner?
Yeah, I was.
Bill, I'm not sure if you've met Judge Angelo Vasta and Mrs. Vasta. Ted, I think this young man's anxious for everyone to get on with the night now and order their tea. And Judge Pratt and Mrs. Pratt.
What's the chef's suggestion, young man?
Chicken chasseur.
I'll have steak, please.
Well done.
Thank you.
And you there, Sir Edward.
Bill, congratulations on your ministry.
You went to the Premier and you put forward Mr. Vasta's name as suitable for appointment to the Supreme Court, didn't you?
I certainly don't recall doing that. Although...
Well, read out the entry.
Ah, it's written down here. It's got... Vasta for Supreme Court.
Not really ambiguous, is it, Sir Terence?
No, it's not.
So has your memory come back?
It certainly has not. And if that is there, and I concede that that's typed there, but I certainly haven't got it in my mind or anywhere else.
On the 2nd of September, your diary reads, saw A. Vasta re-future. Well, do you see that?
Yes.
Whose future? Don't you know?
Well, I can only assume that it would be his future.
Well, that certainly looks the most likely possible.
Yes, yes, I would say that that is what it possibly would be.
You cannot remember what you had to say with Mr. Vasta about his future after having spoken on the two previous days to Sir Edward Lyons and the Premier?
No, I cannot.
You were not putting his name forward for appointment to the bench at that stage?
I certainly was not.
Did you ever put his name forward for appointment to the Supreme Court bench to the Premier?
It is certainly not my position to put him forward for a position in the Supreme Court. There's only one gentleman's name that perhaps I unfortunately mentioned in later times in that category.
Who was that?
Judge Pratt.
That's just not right, what you just said. Throughout this document, there are persistent references to judges, Supreme Court bench, and vacancies.
A Chief Justice position about to come up. Now, I opened this up at random. The 24th of August, 1978... Sturgis, Supreme Court bench.
Yes.
I will take you to the entry on your agenda, a little above halfway down. Phoned around state, 90% of police pro-Joe.
Oh, I certainly don't recall phoning around the state. I'm just wondering who may have done it or where I got it from, but I certainly know that however I got the information, that was about the feeling of the men in the force at the time, that they were fairly pro-Premier.
Surely you must have some recollection. It is a pretty extraordinary event. Mm. In a political and electoral context, the state's policemen are being polled to ascertain the extent of their support for the Premier.
Yeah.
It's not the sort of thing that would slip one's mind, surely, unless it's the sort of thing you do every day.
No.
It's really out of the ordinary, isn't it?
It is. That's why it's got me beat that I can't say where I got the information from.
I mean, it's really not quite proper, is it?
No, I don't think it's improper. If I could answer that, Mr. Chairman, I certainly would do so.
No. The fact that the poll was conducted so that you might report upon the matter to the Premier, that is really quite improper, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I suppose you could say that, yes. I can't.
That's not what you were given control of the police force to do, is it?
There is no way in the world that I can recall phoning anywhere at all around the state. I mean, where I got this information, where I got this information from, whether I got it, I just don't know. Phone police, 90% pro-Joe.
It was improper for you to be the conveyor of such intelligence to the Premier for political purposes, wasn't it?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that it's wrong to tell him that he has the support of the police around the state. I mean, the election is over.
Phoned around the state, 90% of police pro-Joe. Do you think that's the sort of thing that the police commissioner ought to be carrying to the Premier, do you?
The Premier has always been interested in the police activities around our state. And I think it has been said innumerable times that whenever he got off the aircraft or whatever, wherever he was, usually the first people he spoke to were the police.
Tell me, why the hell did you want to write those diaries for?
I wanted to have them as a memory for the future. So I could think about times with you, my friend. Think about times with others. And maybe write a little book.
This is probably the most important question I will ask you, so be very careful in listening to this.
I'm careful all the time.
What do you understand by the doctrine of the separation of powers under the Westminster system?
Of the...
The Westminster system. The doctrine of the separation of powers under the Westminster system.
No, I don't quite know what you're driving at. The document.
I'll say it again. What do you understand by the doctrine of the separation of powers under the Westminster system?
I don't know which doctrine you refer to.
There's only one doctrine of the separation of powers.
I believe in it very strongly. And despite what you may say, I believe that we have a great responsibility to the people who elect us to government. And that is to maintain their freedom and their rights. I did that. Thought to do it always.
I'm sure you're trying to be responsive to the question, but the question relates to the doctrine of the separation of powers under the Westminster system, or the principles.
Between the government and the... Is it?
No, you tell me what you understand.
Well, the doctrine you refer to in relation to the... where the government stands, and where the rest of the community stands, and where the rest of the instruments of government stand. Is that what...
No.
Well, you tell me, and I'll tell you whether you're right or not. Don't you know?
You see, when you received your knighthood, one of the matters that was suggested in the preamble to why you got your knighthood was that you were a strong believer in historic traditions of parliamentary democracy, that you had implemented many improvements in the parliamentary process, and you had rendered extraordinary and important service to the Crown, etc. Now, for years, the Westminster system has functioned, and you repeatedly have stated that you are a great believer in the Westminster system.
Yes.
The question is, do you have any comprehension at all of the three areas under the Westminster system that must be kept separate in order for parliamentary democracy to function?
Yes, I do.
Well, what are they?
Well, I think the system of election, the system, the area of government itself, responsibility to the people.
I'll explain to you what the doctrine of the separation of powers under the Westminster system is, and you tell me if you understand it.
Sure.
Because I don't want to waste the Commission's time by asking you again. It's a requirement under the Westminster system that the executive government and the judiciary and the enforcement arm, namely the police, be kept as separate as possible, subject to the concept of cabinet government.
Yes, that's the important part.
And that there be checks and balances within the system.
Sure.
Well, I suggest to you that your interference in relation to the decision of Mr. Hodges and Mr. Whitbread to investigate the Coronation Drive bashing, you, not being police minister, and interfering in that particular process, flew completely in the face of those principles.
No, I don't believe I did. We had a very unique circumstances, a very difficult circumstances, and I was the one who carried the main responsibility of the government towards the people. And if you had been in my place and heard what the people continually said to me, right throughout the length and breadth of Queensland, words of hope and desire that we would not tolerate a situation or let the situation get out of control. And you're not talking about normal times and normal circumstances.
I have an announcement for the people of Queensland. The National Party of today is not the party that I took the election last year. The policies of the National Party are no longer those on which I went to the people. Therefore, I do not wish to lead this government any longer. It was my intention to take this matter to the floor of State Parliament. However, I now have no interest in leading the National Party any further. I've decided to resign as Premier and retire from Parliament, effective immediately. As this is the last time I will address you as Premier, I wish to say that in the last 40 years, I have had but one objective: to make Queensland a better place in which to live and to work. I've always given of my best. Thank you for your support down the years. I do appreciate your prayers and your messages of love to me and to Flo. I wish you well. Thank you all. Goodbye and God bless.
Premier.
All the best to you all. Thank you very much.
Premier, how do you feel towards Mr. Lahan?
I want to say to you all, thank you for your attendance this afternoon. I wish you well. Happy Christmas.
What are you going to do now, Mr. Speaker,
ladies and gentlemen, I want to say to you, I appreciate your coming, as I said today. I'm a free man. I'm free. I'm going to celebrate tonight up at the Sheraton with my family. Tremendous. All of that.
Premier,
all
of that. Premier,